You are listening to Steele Talking. I am your host, Geralyn Steele. And this half hour, I tell you, it was quite shocking to me as I'm watching political shows this weekend and listening to the radio and listening to political ideas and trying to figure out what happened with the debates. And when it went across the screen and it said Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia has passed away, I cannot tell you how shocking it was. I was a bit paralyzed for a moment. And his loss now leaves a hole, not only in the conservative movement, but with a vacancy, an unexpected vacancy in the country's highest court. And, of course, filling his shoes will be a huge task, a political monster. And the president has said that he will fill the vacancy, as he should, as far as I'm concerned. And Tim Johnson, Professor Tim Johnson, is joining us. He's from the University of Minnesota, a political science professor who specializes in the United States Supreme Court, to kind of give us an understanding of what's next. How does this happen? How does it go when it comes to choosing the next one? But to also talk about Scalia's legacy. What did he leave behind? What will he be remembered for? Welcome to WCCO, Tim. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, this was big news to me. Was it as big of news to you?
Oh, it was. I mean, this is an absolute bombshell. This is one of those events in history that nobody's expecting, and it is so huge because the Supreme Court has been controlled by a conservative majority now for, since 1986, really, more like 25 years, since 1990, 1991, but for so long that it was unclear whether or not that stronghold on the U.S. Supreme Court would ever end.
And here it is, 8 now instead of 9. And, you know, I want to get clarity on something before we talk about his life. I understand that the Supreme Court can be any odd number, and it's up to a president. A president can come in and say, no, we don't want 9. We want 13. We want 11, however many they want. And there have been times throughout our history where that number has changed. And so then it settled on 9. Am I correct on that?
You are correct that it settled on 9, but not on that the president gets to choose. It is up to Congress to determine the number of justices on the U.S. Supreme Court. And it's not always actually been an odd number. It began with 6. And then it did jump to an odd number because that made more sense when you're talking about a majority rule institution. You will note that prior to the assassination of President Lincoln, the number actually jumped to 10. And the reason for that was Congress, in conjunction with President Lincoln, wanted to make sure that there was a majority of Northerners on the bench. And so they upped the number till 10. But interestingly, upon his assassination, upon Andrew Johnson becoming the president, and President Johnson was so hated across the board that Congress actually dropped the number to 7, which meant that when the next 7 justices or the next 3 justices either died or retired from the bench, he would not get to put anyone on the court. When he left office, shortly before the end of the 1860s, in 1869, they actually increased the number back to 9 once he was out of office, and it has stayed at 9 ever since.
I just want to make sure we understand.
Yeah.
We've been playing this political volleyball, basically, with the Supreme Court justices for, you know, decades.
Right.
And in knowing that, that means that it's such a high court. It feels like we should not be playing political volleyball with it. This is too serious of a thing to play politics with. But there's no way we can get out of it because of the way it was set up.
You know, I think that's probably pretty accurate that we're not going to get out of playing politics with it, but I think it's also accurate that we probably should not be doing so, and I would not be surprised that at some point, if in fact the Republican-controlled Senate refuses to entertain a nominee from President Obama, that Chief Justice Roberts, who himself is a Republican appointee, right, George W. Bush put him on the bench and is himself quite conservative, it would not be surprising to me if he came out publicly and said and admonished the Senate and said, to do our work and to do our work properly, we need to have a full complement of justices. You need to confirm someone.
Mm. Well, that's been really difficult for the Congress to do. Getting confirmation has been nearly impossible, depending on where the Congress stands, who holds what offices, who holds the power in the Congress. And because of that, it's like we're frozen in time. Right now, we have so many open seats, not in the Supreme Court, but on so many courts that should have been filled by this president and this Congress, but nothing has been done. And now we have this seat to be filled as well. I have to tell you, I'm not optimistic about it. Are you?
No, I'm not optimistic at this point either, and you're absolutely right. The lower court situation in both U.S. district courts, which are the trial courts, and then the intermediate courts, the U.S. Circuit Courts of Appeals, there are a number of openings, lots of openings on both levels, and that fight actually goes all the way back to the early 1990s when President Clinton was trying to get new folks on the bench. And interestingly, at that time, facing a Republican Senate, a pretty conservative Senate, Chief Justice Rehnquist, who, again, just like Chief Justice Roberts currently is quite conservative, came out publicly and really gave the Senate a hard time and said, in order for the entire federal judiciary to work, we've got to have nominees begin to be confirmed by the Senate.
Exactly. And I don't know if that's ever going to happen unless some miraculous thing happens this year with this election and things will change. But I have to tell you, I'm not really optimistic.
So I will say this. I agree that that my optimism is at a low point with you right now, at least up through November. There is no doubt that if they stop a nominee right now through November, whoever is the new president, even if it is a Democrat, say it's Hillary Clinton, that they will put someone on the U.S. Supreme Court. They will have to. The American public doesn't know enough about the district courts or the circuit courts of appeals to really think a lot about it, because they're not in the public eye. But with the U.S. Supreme Court being such in the public eye, even though it is our most secretive branch of government, the public knows enough to know that if there's only eight on the court, things do not work. And so it's actually a pretty dangerous game the Republicans are going to play right now, because if you take the scenario to the extreme that Hillary Clinton uses this, if we assume she's going to be the nominee, uses this as a battle cry for Democratic voters, she wins. And simultaneously, the Democrats win back the requisite number of seats to take over the Senate. Now, she might get to put someone on the court who's even more liberal. And so the Republicans really, if they're going to play this game, are actually playing a pretty dangerous political game at this point.
Yeah, it's a very dangerous game. And by the way, you know, when you talk about extremes, I am very concerned about the legacy that he left. You know, I can go all the way back to, you know, Schiavo and bringing the Supreme Court, making decisions about that, or President Bush getting into office. And I'm getting a master's degree in leadership. And I have to tell you, there was at one point in time this year, I actually considered transferring and trying to go to law school, you know, just so that I can learn the Constitution, you know, in all of its glory, so I can figure out. So is it legal what the Supreme Court has been doing in the last three decades? And for the life of me, from what I've read, I don't see how it is.
Well, it's interesting, you know, so if you just want to put it in terms of Justice Scalia's legacy, he clearly will be known as the most conservative justice ever to sit on the U.S. Supreme Court. But he is also going to be considered maybe one of the best justices ever to sit on the court, or greatest justices, because he was, and this is, you know, does not have anything to do with whether you agree with his decisions or not, was one of the smartest, one of the wittiest, one of the most acerbic, one of the crabbiest justices ever to sit on the bench. And you are right, he has left a very conservative legacy. He was key in making sure that President Bush won the election in 2000. He wrote the opinion in Heller versus the United States, which made it clear that there was an individual right individual Second Amendment right to carry arms. On the other hand, he had some very surprising opinions. He signed Justice Brennan's opinion, Justice Brennan being one of the most liberal justices of all time. He signed Justice Brennan's opinion in Texas versus Johnson, which upheld the right of American citizens to burn the American flag. He was also.
But can you and I just say, Tim, that sure. It pales in comparison to some of the other decisions that he's made.
Oh, I absolutely agree. But those are some of the decisions that he will be known for, right? So you're right. The conservative legacy, Bush v. Gore, Citizens United, Heller versus the United States, those will go down as the very conservative decisions that he made and helped shape the court with. But he was much more moderate, if you will, on Sixth Amendment criminal rights, Seventh Amendment criminal rights, so the Confrontation Clause, the right to speedy trial. He tried to protect criminal rights when it came to illegal searches and seizures, and not all of the time, but he did have his moments where he was not that bombastic conservative justice that you and I have grown to know.
Well, I tell you, I've watched him from a distance, and, you know, the big Voting Rights Act. And, you know, as an African-American woman, you know, he has seriously infected my life with so many of his decisions in different ways.
Sure.
And so there was a part of me, and I admitted this at the beginning of the show, I'm a Christian woman, but there was a part of me that had some terrible thoughts about him when I first found out that he died. And I kept thinking to myself, why would anyone want to have such, a legacy that I don't see as being positive? But of course, those who are conservative may look at him as a hero. And I think to myself, where does that put us today? There are those who look at him as a hero, and those that really had such disdain for him. Where do we go from here?
Right. You know, I think, you know, the only place that we go from here is to see what sort of justice actually replaces him. So what's interesting about, and this will sort of get to your question, what's interesting about the strategy that the Republicans have come out at least initially with is that if someone is not put on the bench, many of the decisions that are sitting at the court right now will actually end up being most likely 4-4 ties. And what's interesting about the U.S. Supreme Court is that if there is not a majority, then the Supreme Court makes no law.
So the president can't be the breaking tie?
No
law of that when someone dies? Okay, wow.
Absolutely. So what happens is, it's as if the Supreme Court never made the decision. So think about some of the cases that are at the Supreme Court right now. The mandate that comes out of Obamacare for contraceptives for women, the lower court opinion actually ruled in favor of women and against the companies and the individuals who don't want to provide contraceptive coverage. That no longer will actually be upheld, and it probably would have been under the court if Justice Scalia had not died. There's several other cases as well that probably will stay intact. A couple of voting rights cases in terms of how we redistrict or how we decide the concept of one person, one vote. And we also probably are going to see the protection of public unions, teachers' unions in particular, in the Friedrichs case be stopped because the lower court opinion out of the Ninth Circuit found in favor of the unions. And the unions probably were going to lose 5-4. At a minimum, or at a maximum now, that case is probably just 4-4, which leaves the lower court ruling intact, protecting unions.
Wow. You know, here, my concern on face value is that the Supreme Court has received far more power than they should have. Now, when we look at the Constitution, I'm absolutely wrong. But from my perspective, I believe they have far too much power, and it's absolutely frightening to see what is happening. Those decisions, the people that are chosen to be on the Supreme Court, and that is a lifetime job in itself. You know, why can't we bring them to task? Why can't we say, no, you needed to recuse yourself if your wife was involved in this and that, and you didn't, and so therefore we fire you? Why can't we do that?
So the Constitution does not allow that, and the only way to allow that to happen is actually to pass constitutional amendments, and people have talked about that. People have talked about whether or not we have a mandatory retirement age at 70 or whether we switch to judicial elections. The only way to do that is a constitutional amendment, which is very, very difficult to pass, right? There's only been 27 amendments passed to the Constitution since 1791. There's no reason to believe that it would be any easier this time. So until that happens, the justices make their own decisions on issues like recusals. They make their own decisions on their internal rules. And you're absolutely right. That is a lot of power to vest in 9 unelected justices. But I will tell you this, for well over 200 years now, it has actually, for the most part, worked relatively well.
Worked relatively well. My goodness, I'd love to sit in your seat and believe that, I tell you. Seriously. We're going to hear a lot about this week. What is the thing that you think we should be paying attention to when it comes to Scalia's legacy and what's going to happen with his seat?
Right. So I think in terms of his legacy, we're going to see this initial couple of days where there is going to be, love him or hate him, there's going to be a lot of talk about his legacy, a lot of talk about how he has figured prominently in the last quarter of the 20th century in the first almost quarter of the 21st century in terms of shaping the law. Again, like it or not, that's where it's, or like him or not, that's where it's going to be. And after that, it's going to turn very quickly to the nomination process. And I would expect that this president, President Obama, is not going to wait too long, because the argument he has right now is there's 11 months. And what we know is that the average Supreme Court nominee, all the way back to George Washington's time of nominating Supreme Court justices, has only been an average of 125 days to confirmation. And that actually cuts against the Republicans' argument that there's not enough time. And we know that the average number of days, or we've never had anyone more than 125 days, and the average number of days to confirmation is 25. And so I think you're going to see an administration move very quickly, put the ball in the Republicans' court, and say, if you do not, Mitch McConnell, majority leader in the Senate, and the rest of the Senate Republicans, if you do not want to confirm a nominee now, let's just see what's going to happen in this presidential campaign. And I think it will make the Democratic nominee, be it Clinton or be it Sanders, have a very clear argument to say to the American people, the Republicans are being obstructionist, and you need to put us into office to stop it.
It hasn't worked yet, but I must say, I wish they would put it in the hands of the people. We the people. Can we the people please have a say in this? That's all I'm saying.
Fair enough.
Professor Tim Johnson, thank you so much for joining us. I wish we had a whole nother half hour.
Not a problem. Have a great night.
You too. Again, that is Professor Tim Johnson of the University of Minnesota, political science professor who specializes in the United States Supreme Court. Let me take a breath and get an aspirin. We'll be back in a moment.